the Progressive Radio Network.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, well, you know, the news gets more interesting every week, doesn't it? At least the economic news. Not that it's all that bright, but it certainly is significant. Okay, today, the main theme I want to talk about is that silly V-shaped recovery assumption. You know, you got a lot of economists out there who think this is going to be a deep down and a deep back, a fast back recovery, V-shaped, right? Well, I don't believe that for a minute, and I'm going to explain to you why. But first, I want to talk about the big news of this day, which, of course, is the jobs number, right? Reported 700,000 job losses here for March. And the unemployment rate rises from 3.5% to only 4.4%. Well, wait a minute. We're watching in the news and everything about hundreds of thousands, millions of unemployment benefit filings, right? The last 2 weeks, last week, this week, 6.6 million filed for unemployment benefits. The week before that, 3.3 million. In other words, 10 million filed for unemployment benefits in just the last 2 weeks of March. That 10 million, by the way, is more than we lost in jobs during the entire last great recession of 19 months. Now, that recession went officially from December 2007 through June of 2009, 19 months, and we lost, I think it was 8.9 million jobs. Well, we've lost 10 million in 2 weeks. Well, how the hell is it that the unemployment rate only rises from 3.5% to 4.4? Well, I'll tell you, it's mostly because the unemployment statistics only collected for the first 2 weeks in March. The 10 million aren't even in that number. And by the way, 10 million is not the full amount of people who were unemployed in the last 2 weeks. That's just people who filed for unemployment benefits. You see, the two definitions aren't the same. Unemployment benefit filings does not pick up everybody who's lost their job. Why? Because some people don't file for unemployment right away. Some people are not eligible for unemployment. Some people just give up and drop out of the labor force, in which you're not eligible. You got to be looking for work to be considered unemployed in the previous 4 weeks. So, lots of reasons why the unemployment benefits number is just a subset of the total unemployed. So, the 10 million is really millions more. But none of it, 10, 12, whatever the millions are that lost their jobs in the last 2 weeks, are not included in that official employment report that just came out this morning, which showed 3.5% unemployment rising to 4.4. Now, another thing you got to realize, and I've said many times, that 3.5% is really a bogus statistic that they keep repeating. Why? Because it only counts full-time employees who lost their jobs. Full-time. You know, there's 165 million people in the workforce. At least 60 million of them are not full-time employed. They're part-time, temp, contract, gig jobs, whatever. 60 million, my estimate. Of course, the Labor Department has a much smaller estimate. Well, if there's 60 million, they're not included. Well, they're the folks that are going to get laid off first. And most of them, by the way, the part-time temp contingent jobs, as we call them, are in the service sector. And it's the service sectors that shut down big time with the shelter in place orders by the states. So it's much bigger than 3.5 or 4.4. And then I've heard that there was an error in the categorization of the unemployment survey here that gives us this unemployment number, the household survey, and that this survey error would have raised it to 5.4%. I don't know what that means. I haven't looked at it yet, but, you know, they can't even follow their own rules here, apparently. But even at 5.4, that's nowhere near the 10 to 12, 13 million who lost their jobs in just the last 2 weeks. And by the way, that's the tip of the iceberg. That's going to continue. Okay, full-time only, not the last 2 weeks, and even the 10 million last 2 weeks is less than the actual job loss. All right, keep that in mind. And then, of course, we have, what about those who are still working? Well, their hours are being cut, you see? Their hours are being cut. Another statistic reported here is involuntary part-time unemployment. In other words, those part-time involuntary. Involuntary means I'd rather be working if I had the chance, a full-time job. You know, I mean, we're talking about millions of people in that category. That unemployment went up by 1.4%. So what's that? 1.4 million, excuse me, 1.4 million. Well, what typically happens is businesses lay off the part-timers and the temps and so forth first, right? And then they move into the full-time. Okay, so that means it's the most vulnerable who are being sacked right now. But as this thing goes on, it's going to dig deeper. You know, even in those industries like restaurants, which are all shut down virtually, right? Lost almost a 500,000 jobs reported in those numbers of the first 2 weeks. Retail, almost 50,000 jobs. Okay. Manufacturing, construction, 20, 30,000 jobs. Professional services, big category. Also job losses. The only place we had job gains is in the federal government hiring 18,000. But 17,000 of those are census workers, you see. So it's across the board, everywhere. Massive job loss, much greater than what they're even showing. And already the economy was slowing down, as I've been arguing many times on the show. You know, you look at the data there in the fourth quarter and even the early months of this year. Well, real investment contracting 9 months in a row last year, manufacturing in recession 6 months in a row, Trump's trade war impacting, net exports, as they say, contribution to GDP. And household consumption, you know, they talk about, oh, consumption is holding everything up. But if you look behind the numbers, you know, the median family income workers, defaults on credit cards, more than 8%. You know, normal is 2%. And if you look overall, okay, it looks normal. But if you segment that and you look at the middle class, right, they're already defaulting. They were already defaulting on credit cards. Yeah. And turning in 7 million of their autos that they bought that they can't pay. And who knows what the default rate is on student loans, because they doctor that all up, you see. All right. So wage stagnation going on. We argued about that. So the consumer, the household, the consumer, particularly middle class and below, was really hurting here already. What this COVID-19 has done is exacerbate and accelerate significantly the trend that was already beginning to appear in the economy, the weakening U.S. economy and global economy for that matter. You know, Japan already in a deep recession, fourth quarter. Europe already stagnated, and key economies like Italy and Germany already negative, slightly negative in terms of growth. You know, and then economies around the world, Latin America and elsewhere, producing commodities and oil already in recession. So, you know, what we see now is an exacerbation, an acceleration, a telescoping of the trends that already existed in the economy. Now, this is very much unlike 2006-07, when the economy was booming and then the financial crash happened, you see. And the financial crash then froze the credit system, and it pretty much tripped over into the real economy. So the financial crash brought down the real economy that was really quite robust on the eve of the Great Recession of 2007-08-09. It was already pretty strong. Well, now we're going into one here with the economy very weak, U.S. and globally. And now you have the crisis, not on the financial side, but on the real side of the economy. You know, I'm talking about, you know, the consumption, the investment, the manufacturing, construction side, the real economy, we call that, as opposed to the financial side, stock markets, bond markets, and all that, currencies, derivatives, etc., right? So in other words, we've reversed the causal relationship between the financial cycles and the real cycles. In 2008, it was the crash on the real side that froze up credit that then caused the shutdown, increasingly, the real economy. Here, we got a collapse of the real economy going on, part of which was already occurring, and part of which is just due to this, the health crisis. But, you know, the health crisis sort of clouds over, obfuscates what was really going on in the real economy. There's two things going, you know. I don't agree with Robert Reich, who says, oh, this is not an economic crisis. This is just a health crisis. And as soon as we get hold of the health crisis, then the economy will snap right back, V-shape. Well, I'm going to talk about that nonsense. Okay. All right. Pre-March of this year, economy was already very weak, and now it's taking a deep dive, and we may see the crisis collapse of the real economy spill over to the financial side of the economy. And it was just reverse of what happened in 2008. You see, these financial cycles interact with the real cycles, and they both feed back upon each other and amplify each other in the direction in which they're moving, i.e. right now, a contraction, a deep contraction. They feed off of each other. Most economists don't understand financial cycles at all. You know, they're trained in non-financial variables, what we call the national income accounts, you know, investment and consumption and so forth. They don't know a thing about the financial side. And then, you know, your financial people don't really understand the real side. So you got this split in knowledge. There's some, of course, but basically a split among the academics specializing and not understanding the full picture of how these financial cycles interact causally and transmit their crisis to the real side and vice versa. Look, I've been saying, if you go back to my 2010 book, you know, I make a distinction between normal recessions, great recessions, and depressions. Normal recessions are when you just have a contraction on the real side of the economy, but it does not precipitate a financial contraction. Great recessions are when you have a financial contraction associated with a real contraction that exacerbates and deepens the decline of the real economy. And the deeper and the faster you go into the decline, the longer it takes to recover. You don't get deep, fast contractions resulting in fast V-shape recoveries. They end up more of a U-shape, you might say. Takes a while. Well, the last one took quite a while. You know, the banks got bailed out in 2010, no later than that, but the real economy just stumbled along, and jobs did not come back for 6 years. You know, the job level we had in December 2007 was not fully recovered until 2015. And then most of the jobs that came back were lower pay. In other words, we churned out higher paying jobs over the recovery period for lower paying jobs. And, you know, that data is irrefutable. It's there that shows that. Well, that was that recovery. Right? And this one could be even worse. Certainly, we got the big contraction in the real economy. We don't know how long that's going to go on because we don't know how long the virus effect will take a toll. But the deeper and the longer it goes, the harder it's going to be to recover. And we are on the cusp of a financial crisis as well. That's why the Fed's throwing trillions and trillions of dollars bailing out the banks and the financial markets even before there's a crisis. That's another difference with 2008, you know? You had the crisis and then the bank bailed them out. I'm talking about the Federal Reserve Bank bailing out the other banks and financial system. Well, now you got even a more massive bailout going even before they collapse, these markets collapse. We'll talk about the bailout here on the financial side. You know, we hear a lot about the stimulus bill, the $2 trillion, 2.3, I don't know what it is now. Haven't had a chance to go through that 880-page actual act or bill to find out the truth. By the way, there's a lot of business tax cuts in there as well, you know, that make it more than $2 trillion. Well, I've written on my blog some articles here. Take a look at them, jackrasmus.com, you know, reporting on what the stimulus bill was. And I'll be writing on what the Fed bailout is. Still a work in progress going on in that regard. But, you know, basically, if you look at the $2 trillion at the time, first announcement, it was $2 trillion. Over a trillion of that goes to businesses. Over a trillion. Non-bank businesses. Yeah, the $500 billion slush fund to big corporations, $58 billion of which go to airlines, $60 billion of which goes to Boeing. By the way, the airlines, you know, the airlines are, you know, good example of the slush fund here. Airlines in recent years gave their shareholders $45 billion in stock buybacks and dividends. $45 billion. And now they need $58 billion. Oh, what are we doing? Filling that black hole that they gave to themselves? Yeah, that's what's happening. You know? And, you know, they're getting a free ride. And the same with Boeing. You know, Boeing, you know, stopped its big buybacks there in 2019 when the MAX 737 ran into trouble, right? But they had given tens of billions of dollars to their shareholders in recent years, too. You know, and now we give them $60 billion? Yeah. You know, as I've just predicted on my Twitter account, watch Boeing take care of its shareholders again indirectly, and watch them eventually to move their operations from Seattle to South Carolina. You know, they got operations they set up in South Carolina to get out from under the unionized workforce in Seattle. And they've been slowly moving production to Seattle. And the last union contract let them do it. A contract that was pushed down the throats of the workers, you know, who first turned it down. And then a union leadership over Christmas did a mail ballot and didn't tell everybody. And then they had a second vote and pushed it through, you see. And a lot of that allows Boeing now to move to South Carolina. operations. And they're going to do that now. They're going to take advantage of this crisis to do that. They'll downsize Seattle and they'll move a lot of the operations to non-union South Carolina. Okay, so that's Boeing, right? By the way, you know, the bailout to Boeing is supposed to have given them, you know, the $60 billion if they use it to maintain wages. You know, a big part of that, most of that was supposed to go to maintain wages, maintain its workers, its labor force, who are shuttered now at home. Well, what's Boeing doing? You know, it's just announced big buyouts. In other words, get off of our employment ranks, folks. Here, take a buyout. We'll fund the buyout out of the pension fund, right? And we'll get the money for $60 billion from the government, and instead of using it for wages, we'll use it for ourselves. Yeah, those are the games they play. And we use it to move to South Carolina. Yeah, those are the games they play. They game it, you know. $500 billion slush fund here for big business corporations. By the way, you know, the big business, do they really need it? Look, just before this happened in January, February, they knew it was coming. Big business knew this thing was coming. And they started drawing down their credit lines with banks. In other words, you get a credit line for $10 billion. You don't use it all at once. You know, it's over the next 5 years or whatever. The agreement with the bank is you can draw it down as you need it. So they, most of them drew down, you know, the whole balance on the credit line. You know, dash for cash. So they were fat with cash for that reason. And they were fat with cash by record issuing of corporate bonds in January and February. Record, you know, something like $240 billion in 1 month worldwide, almost $100 billion in the U.S. in 1 month in February in issuing corporate bonds. When they do that, of course, they get cash for the bonds. They give the investor the bonds, and they take the cash and they sit on it. So they're sitting on these massive credit lines of cash. They're sitting on these bond issues of cash. And now they're going to get $500 billion more. Well, let's take, you know, $58 billion for the airlines and $60 billion for Boeing. That leaves about $400 billion there. Okay. Yeah. Do they really need it? Well, you know, what are the conditions in which they're going to get it? You know, how effective their lobbyist is. That's the condition. You know, Democrats in Congress said, oh, we need an oversight committee because, you know, these guys gamed it all in 2008-09. We need an oversight committee to see that the money goes to big businesses that really need it. And we need inspector general, and they'll determine and they'll oversight and see, you know, make sure there's not any funny games going on. Well, Donald Trump said, no, I'm the oversight. He's just going to stonewall Congress and this inspector and this board. He's not going to let him see what's going on. Watch him dip into it himself, I bet, for his own businesses. Yeah. Okay, so, you know, who do you think is going to win that game, right? That fight? Congress? You know, the House? Or Donald? Yeah, well, I won't bet on that. Okay, so, you know, we got this big slush fund, this bailout, and so forth. Now, part of the stimulus also provides, and positively here, you know, $500 billion in checks, emergency checks, income checks to households, you know, taxpaying, everyone who filed taxes and who has a Social Security account, whatever, will get the $1,200 per person. If you're making $75,000 or less a year in income, and then prorated, you know, portion of that up to $99,000 per person per household, $198,000 income cutoff there for couples and $500. So, you know, $2,400, $1,200 each for couples, and then $500 per kid. Okay, well, that's good. That's good. You know, it can't be against that. Will that really cover it? Think about it. Even if you're a couple, $2,400, all right, you're unemployed, lost your job. Well, you know, you're in San Francisco, the median rent is $3,000 a month, the median, right? New York City, probably more. And they won't even cover your rent, see? Well, you're able to file for unemployment benefits too. Well, people are having a hard time getting through that procedurally because it's so many of them. But unemployment benefits, another plus increase there of $600 on top of what you were making max unemployment. That's good, that's a start. But that whole stimulus bill is only going to last 6 to 8 weeks at the most, you see. It's not even a stimulus of the economy. You know, even Pelosi says it's a mitigation bill. That's true. It's what it is. It's mitigation, not a stimulus. They're going to have another stimulus bill, you know, really for the economy come May, June. Oh, but the Republicans are going to resist that. No, they don't like that. And they don't like it because they already got a trillion dollar deficit this year because of Trump's tax cuts in the previous 2 years and defense war spending increases hundreds of billions a year. Yeah, they already had $1 trillion before facing this. And what's the deficit going to be this year? Well, according to some bank research departments, I forget if it's Morgan Stanley or one of the other ones, $3.7 trillion deficit this year. And next year, another $3 trillion deficit. That's the government budget deficit. That's not counting the deficit the Federal Reserve is going to run and the debt it's going to run up. That's another $4 trillion, you see. So Republicans are facing, $7 trillion in next 2 years in additional budget deficit, national debt at $22.5 trillion already going to $30 trillion by 2021. They're going to do everything they can to slow down any stimulus that's going to the working class, of course. They'll pass more freebies for big corporations if they have to. Yeah. And, I just wrote a piece here. Check it out on my blog, or you can go to Counterpunch blog, ZNED blog, Global Research blog, others, called COVID-19 and the Forgotten Working Class. In other words, the working class is still working. They're throwing out some token support for the unemployed, correctly so, in an election year. They worry about that. By the way, if this thing gets worse, don't discount the possibility that Trump will try to, postpone the election in November. Although constitutionally you can't do that, only Congress can do that. But, what does he care about the Constitution? And if he doesn't postpone it and he loses it, he'll raise a fraud election. And then we're going to have a real crisis on our hands. We think we got a crisis now. Wait till that happens. Well, I'm not trying to be alarmist. I'm just saying that, just keep that in your back pocket. If it gets much worse, which it possibly could economically and health-wise. Okay. Back to this article I wrote on my blog, jackrasmus.com. You can read it. COVID-19 and the Forgotten Working Class. Forgotten meaning those who are workers, we give some benefits to the unemployed, but how about those who are working? We say, they're heroes. Well, they are, they're out there working, in a very unhealthy, they're the front lines. They're the front lines in this war on the virus. They're exposing themselves to illness and death out there. All we're giving them is, nice verbal kudos here. We're saying, they're heroes, Listen to Trump and listen to the media talking heads. Well, that doesn't cut it. You know, we should be taking better care of these people. This is hazard pay. You know, in union contracts, hazard pay, you know, you get time and a half if you're in a very, serious kind of a risky occupation. Right? We should be giving these people time and a half of their base pay. And, you know, we should be giving double time pay after 10 hours. They should be provided full health care coverage. Those who don't have it, you know, only half have some kind of employer coverage, and then they often have big deductibles and co-pays and all that, well, Trump says their United Healthcare is going to forego that. Well, he's been saying a lot of things, and I don't necessarily believe him. You know, he may have discussions with some of these health insurance companies, but this doesn't mean it's real. You know, he said we're doing millions of tests and we had all these ventilators and all this stuff. You know, it lies like hell. Can't believe a word this guy says. You know, he comes on his press conferences every day, which are election campaigning events, right? And he just spins it. You know, it's a marketing spin. You know, it's a sales pitch. You know, he ran his company the same way he running the United States and running it into the ground, both of them. That's what this guy is. Oh, but you know, he really switched here, didn't he? The last press conference, when it became clear that hundreds of thousands are going to die, you know, he's a wartime president and hundreds of thousands are dropping like flies here, you know, under his generalship. You know, if we had someone military command, you know, army, navy, whatever, in an external war, and you know, just think about it. You know, if the U.S. Navy after Pearl Harbor went out there at Midway and all the U.S. Aircraft carriers were sunk instead of Japanese, right, in the Battle of Midway, we lost all three carriers. Do you think that those admirals wouldn't be sacked? Yeah, they would be. There'd be a total reorganization of the Navy and the military. Yeah. Or if, D-Day had failed miserably in Europe, you know, you think Eisenhower would not have been sacked? Yeah, he would have. Well, here's this guy, hundreds of thousands, far more that died, you know, on those two fronts in World War II. Hundreds of thousands dying because of his negligence and his incompetence and his disbelief that this thing was real, and nothing happens to him. Yeah, nothing happens. Well, what kind of wartime president is he? And by the way, I wrote an article about Trump as wartime president, comparing him to FDR. That's on my blog, too. Take a look at that. Well, back to what the working class should be getting. You know, we talked about hazard pay, time and a half, double time after 10, because they're working long hours. They should be full health care coverage provided under an emergency new Part E of Medicare. Now, is anybody who doesn't have health insurance, they should be able, like signing up for unemployment benefits, to sign a one-page sign-up to be covered for the emergency period here under Medicare, a new Part E Medicare, and the government should give the money instead of to the health insurance companies, should give the money, and the corporations should give the money to the Medicare Trust Fund to implement and distribute. Part E Medicare, yeah, create a new Part E Medicare for emergency situations like this. And by the way, you know, you won't have these massive deductibles that you have under, and copays that you know, Medicare copay, what is that, you pay $135 at the beginning of the year? You know, that's your, quote, deductible, hospitalization 100%, everything covered, doctors 80%, and you can purchase a supplement, private insurance to cover the other 20%, you know, prescription drugs covered. Why we're not talking about Medicare? Well, you know, Bernie Sanders and those folks are, but boy, they're really being shut out, stifled. All right, there should be also a 90-day moratorium on apartment rent or home mortgage payment for those folks out there on the front line still working. Yeah, if you want to really raise their disposable income, that's what you should do. The government should reimburse credit card interest charges. And reimburse auto loan monthly payments, or at least the interest part of that. Credit cards and auto interest should be reimbursed by the government, you know, through the next tax filing. Well, that's not so radical. You know, that's what we used to do in the 1970s. You know, your interest charges for all your credit cards and whatever were tax deductible. Yeah, they were tax deductible. They stopped that when Reagan came in. Also, there was a lid on what credit cards could charge. It was 7%. Well, when Reagan comes in, he lifts that lid. And now, of course, you know, interest charge like 25, 30% on your credit cards. Well, you know, make that reimbursable tax credit for everybody out there working still on the front line. Give them a benefit. And what about a clothing allowance tax credit for the cost of cleaning? You know, in a lot of these jobs, you got to come back and clean your clothes, wash them every day, right? And PPE equipment, you know, that they are purchasing themselves because the government doesn't provide it. Give them a tax credit. We used to have a clothing tax credit on the job, you know, but Trump got rid of that in the last tax bill. Yeah. This stuff isn't rocket science. It's not so complex. I'm telling you, if we don't do something about these people on the front lines who are keeping the whole thing from collapsing, they're just going to walk away. You're going to say, hell with this. You know, I'm going to go back, take care of my family here. You know, I'm risking myself and therefore my whole family if I get sick and die. My whole family. What am I doing out here? Yeah, well, you better make some compensation to make it worthwhile for these people, or they're just going to walk off. And then you're going to see how important workers are to the economy and to civilization itself. These, you know, typical workers, you know, they're not working in high-tech software engineers. These are people who are, you know, picking up your garbage. You know, these are people who are working long hours in the hospitals and the clinics and everything. These are people who are delivering your mail. These are people who are driving the trucks short and long haul. These are people in the warehouses and in the grocery stores, you know, or making sure you still have food, and in the pharmacies to make sure you still have medicine. These are assembly line workers and still, you know, trying to produce PPE that we need, right? And they're even volunteer workers who are keep delivering, you know, meals to grandma and grandpa who can't get out and checking in on them to see if they're still alive. You know, these are, quote, the lowly occupations, but this is what holds the whole system together. They stop working. Everything crashes around your ears. So why the hell aren't we rewarding them somehow with something more than just, oh, you're heroes. You can't eat that. Well, avoid that at your risk, all you capitalists out there. You think it's going to go on forever that way? People are just going to work the long hours and expose themselves to illness and death and risk their families? No, there'll come a time they're going to put down their tools, as you say, and walk away. All right. Moving on. You know, I promised I would get to this this topic of V-shaped recovery. That nonsense out there. Right. The forecasts are of GDP, first quarter, a negative 2.5% contraction of GDP. And second quarter, 20% contraction. You know, Goldman Sachs had forecast a 24% contraction about a week or so ago, of second quarter GDP, the economy, in other words. But Morgan Stanley had forecast 30%. Well, the consensus among economists is like 20%. Economists are always more conservative. You know, they're always playing it safe. You know, they look at each other, well, if I say something that may be true, I believe it, but it's out of the ordinary, all my peers would castigate me, make fun of me. So, you know, I'm going to forecast what everyone else is forecasting. Play it safe. Mm-hmm. Well, the worst case scenario is 3.7% among this economists for the first quarter contraction and 31% for the second quarter. Mm-hmm. But... they're forecasting a 10 to 15% snapback recovery in the third quarter. A V-shape, in other words. Well, let me burst that bubble for you. You know, why there will be no V-shape recovery here. First of all, you know, the biggest part of the economy are household spending, 70% almost, and business investment, about 10%, 80%, you know, of the economy. Now, business spends by investing, right? And households spend by consuming. But when there's so much uncertainty out there and expectations of my income may not last or my profits and revenue may not recover and are going down pretty fast, right? Expectations of profitability, rate of return, whatever you want to call it, are very negative. And same thing for households. So what that means is even if the health side of this thing is checked, you know, when we peak in June and it seems to be going down, right? Business is not going to turn around and invest heavily in a recovery. They don't know what consumption is going to be. They're not going to increase production. They're going to wait because their expectations, their uncertainty of are going to be so negative. And the same with households, right? The households are going to be very cautious about spending again. Because they'll never know whether, oh, this is just one wave and another wave coming. And, oh, it's going to get that way. They're talking about another wave when winter comes again. You know, and there's no vaccine. There's no solution to this. No one knows what actually is going to continue to happen. So they're hoarding cash, both businesses and households, hoarding cash. You know, a while ago when I said businesses were drawing down their credit lines and issuing all these corporate bonds, you know, that's a dash for cash, as they say, or in economists' jargon, a liquidity preference, cash, money, liquidity preference. Hoarding for emergencies, save more instead of spend it, right? Consumption goes down if savings goes up. Hoarding cash or paying down debt, because now they're taking on more debt, you know, during the crisis. So they're going to use whatever a money injection they get, you know, the $1,200 unemployment, you know, it's not going to cover their expenses, but they're going to try to squeeze the money and save some of it for the unknown future. So hoarding a cash, paying down debt, right? Both existing debt, which is pretty heavy, and the new debt that they're taking on during the crisis here, is going to be a major debt overhang on the economy. It's going to keep investment and spending from recovering very quickly, if at all. Now, you know, if you're having investment and people buying cars and homes and so forth, you know, consumption, then they got to borrow the money somewhere, right? Bank lending. Well, you're going to see banks aren't going to be lending as generously as they were before, because they didn't after the 2008-09 crash. Bank lending contracted for years after that, even after it was so called over. The banks are going to hoard money too. They're going to get a loan to their best, largest multinational customers. We saw that happen. A lot of the money is going to, that the Fed is trying to push into the economy, is going to sit on their balance sheets. But even with low lending, you see, or very little lending or slow recovery of bank lending, who's to say that businesses and consumers will even want to borrow from the banks? Yeah, the demand for funds, as we say in economics jargon, by businesses and by households will be very, very weak. Right? The lending will be weak as well, but the borrowing will be weak. I mean, who wants to borrow money and expand your business, which is what you're going to have to do if you want a V-shaped recovery, when it's unclear what the future is going to be and whether people are going to buy my stuff? No business is going to jump with both feet into that. And the same with households. They're not going to do it either. So the demand for loans by non-bank businesses is going to be quite low and recover quite slowly. And the same with households. You're not going to get as much spending. No. They're going to hoard the cash. They're going to pay down their debt. They're going to save. They're going to be very careful on what they spend, especially on big ticket items like houses and cars and so forth. Now, on top of that, government spending. Okay, well, there's a gush of government spending now, $2 trillion here. By the way, I said it's going to have to be at least $4 trillion, all of it, to households if you want to stimulate the economy. At least $4 trillion. And not the way we have it now, where one for workers and two for businesses, you see. $500 billion for workers, $1 trillion for businesses, and the rest, of course, is miscellaneous and multiplier effects and so forth to get the $2 trillion out of that. Okay, government spending, if the last recession is any indication, government spending, while it will be initially pumping money into the economy, will try to take it out pretty quick again. Well, look what happened with Obama. You know, Obama comes into office during the last crisis, January 2009, passes his recovery bill, right? $787 billion in government spending, $300 billion, of course. Went to tax cuts that had virtually no effect. Another $250 billion went to the states, who also hoarded it. And, you know, the rest was long-term investment projects without immediate effect. You know, so that the composition of Obama's stimulus bill was terrible. And that's why we had such a slow recovery as well. You know, they had to supplement that with programs like Cash for Clunkers. In other words, go buy a car and we'll give you $8,000 or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or first-time home buyers, right? Two supplement programs because its initial bailout did not work. And then what happened a year later when the economy still wasn't recovering, the real economy in 2010, we're still losing jobs in 2010, what did he do? Mm-hmm. Well, he gave business another $800 billion in tax cuts. And who was running their you know, his jobs program? Well, it was this guy, I forget, from GE. Was it Welch? I forget his name. No. Yeah, they put big business in charge of the jobs program. Yeah, that was Obama's recovery. And then, in August 2011, Obama and the Democrats, after they lose control of the House of Representatives because their recovery was so weak and he blew it, then in 2011, Obama agrees to cut spending on social programs by $1.5 trillion. And then at the end of 2012, he gives business another $5 trillion tax cut over the next 10 years. Yeah. In other words, he just extended George W. Bush's tax cuts, very pro-business investor, for another 10 years. Yeah, that's what he did. That was his recovery. In other words, they turned to austerity as soon as they can. Austerity meaning let's cut government spending. You know, we put money in there to keep it from collapsing. Oh, well, it's not collapsing any further. It's not recovering, but at least it's not collapsing. Well, let's take some of the money back. That's what austerity is. And that's what Obama did. Well, they'll do the same thing because already the banks are predicting, as I already said, $3 trillion deficit increase this year and 3.7 this year and $3 trillion next year. That's $7 trillion more. Well, you know, the U.S. debt, government debt, $22.5 trillion. You add $7 trillion to that, you're at $30 trillion U.S. national debt, and you're going to pay interest on that, you see? Even before this happened, the Congressional Budget Office estimated that by 2028, the deficit would be so large because of Trump tax cuts that we'd be paying $900 billion a year just in interest on the debt. And that was before all this happened, and the $6.7 trillion next 2 years going to happen in increase in deficit and debt. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, if we take back that, it's going to slow the recovery, just as, you know, bank lending is going to be slow to recover, just as the demand for funds is going to be low by both households and businesses, hoarding the cash, saving, paying down debt. In other words, consumption is not going to snap back. Investment's not going to snap back. Government spending will probably be cut back. And then there's global trade. And, of course, we saw with Trump's trade wars that was a drag on the economy, too. Well, now we've got a collapse of the global economy. A collapse. You know, total GDP worldwide is about $80 trillion a year. Well, we're going to lose at least 5 to 10 trillion of that globally. In other words, other countries and regions of the global economy are worse off than we are, believe it or not. You know, Europe, Japan, Latin America, all these commodity-producing countries, and China contracting for the first time in decades. And, oh, well, China's going to snap back. Well, you know, a lot of China's growth is dependent upon exports. And if the rest of the global economy is sinking and trade is sinking, contracting, well, who are they going to sell their exports to? No one can afford to buy them. Well, maybe we'll buy ventilators, right? They're the only guys who got them. Or masks, you know. By the way, you know, California Governor Newsom, he's quietly shipping Chinese ventilators because he can't get them from Trump. Yeah, Trump sent him a couple hundred, and they were all broke. You know, what did they do? Select out all the broken ones there and send them to California because he hates California? Well, maybe, yeah. You know, why did hundreds of them come from Trump and FEMA that didn't work? We had to repair them here in California. Well, you know, the smart governors who got a jump on all this, like Newsom in California, you know, they're buying them from China. By the way, you know, other governors are, and I think now that quietly Trump will never mention it that he's getting this stuff from China, right? He'll never mention it. You know, quietly they're shipping stuff from offshore, you know, and Trump says, I'm going to authorize the War Defense Act, or War Production Act, right? 8 weeks after the whole thing starts, you see. It takes him eight. He authorizes it weeks ago, but authorization doesn't mean anything. Authorization was just a marketing spin to make it look like he's doing something. He didn't issue any executive order to start production of this. Well, now, just a couple days ago, he said, okay, we can start production. Yeah. Huh. What a wartime president that is, huh? Compare him to FDR. You know what FDR's first executive order was when after Pearl Harbor? I'll tell you. It was to mass produce penicillin. And we did it within months. You know, penicillin been around, but they couldn't mass produce it. Well, they knew, you know, World War One. Most of the, you know, the military died because of infections, not because of combat wounds. It was infections after, and the flu. Spanish flu epidemic. You know? So, you know, first executive order, mass-produced penicillin, which we did. Now, that's a wartime president. Where's the executive order here? You know, what he should have done was, okay, take over that war Lordstown abandoned auto plant, right? Mobilize the government acquisition of all the resources to make ventilators, seize them if necessary, move, necessary people, manufacturing people into Lordstown, build accommodations for them, requisition construction materials from the nearby area, and start producing this stuff ourselves. Well, that's what we did in World War II, you see. U.S. government built factories and then leased it to the private sector for a buck. They didn't wait on the private sector to start producing this stuff. They did it themselves. All right, well, that's a wartime president, and that's not Trump. That's for damn sure. Okay, so, collapse of global trade is going to hold back the V-shaped recovery. Business cost-cutting. You know, whenever we have crises like this, business starts learning how to operate on lower costs, right? And then they just carry that over into the recovery period. They don't hire as many people. They hire them at a lower pay. They know how to inventory better. They know how to manipulate their suppliers better. They hire people at lower wages, right? So that cost cutting is going to continue into the recovery as well. And by the way, the whole crisis here is going to accelerate artificial intelligence, which is going to hit us mid this decade, eliminating simple decision-making jobs. Well, that's going to come sooner now. Businesses are going to implement AI in manufacturing and distribution and so forth. So that will slow down the V-shaped recovery. And then finally, what if the Fed's spending of trillions of dollars to bail out the banks and financial system does not work? If it doesn't work, well, then you got a financial crash on top of your real contraction, right? What if the preemptive bailout going on now does not result in businesses actually increasing investment and production, or banks actually lending at a robust rate, or businesses and households actually borrowing in order to increase consumption and investment? What if that does not happen? Well, then we are in what's a great recession, where the two financial cycles, as I said at the beginning of the show, begin to interact with each other, exacerbate each other, in a mutual amplifying feedback effect. Then it gets worse. Again, I don't agree with Reich that this is just a health crisis, because the financial system is teetering on the edge. And a great recession is where you have the two financial and real economies crashing together. Normal recession is where you only have one, the real economy. A great depression is when you have a series of financial crashes, one after the other. That's what happened in the 1930s. You know, we had the stock market crash in 29. Then we had a banking crash, first one in 30, another banking crash in 31, another in 32, another in 33. The economy just kept ratcheting down deeper, deeper, deeper. So that's the difference between a great recession, or what I called epic recession in my 2010 book, and a great depression. Now, what we did in 2008, we held it at a great recession, only one financial crash, right? But in the 1930s, there were a sequence of financial crashes. In 1907-8, it was one financial crash. You see, that's the difference between a great recession and a bona fide depression. Okay, and what we got going on here, we will see. But the V-shaped recovery is a lot of Pollyanna, pie-in-the-sky nonsense. It's not going to happen, folks. No way. Okay, we'll revisit it next week.